This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, March 8, 2006. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, thousands of immigrants and their supporters take to Capitol Hill to protest federal legislation. We'll hear from New Orleans, where levees are being rebuilt according to half-century-old climate data. Plus, it's International Women's Day. FSRN brings you voices from New York to Nicaragua and beyond. But first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Philippine police today broke up a rally marking International Women's Day and detained a lawmaker and a labor activist for leading the protest. Girly Lanao reports from Manila.
Thousands of people took to the streets in Manila today to mark International Women's Day and again demand for President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo's resignation. The demonstrations were the first to be held since President Arroyo lifted a week-long emergency rule last Friday. The end of the state of emergency, however, has not stopped the crackdown on the government's opponents. Demonstrations without permits are also still banned. Leftist Congresswoman Risa Barakel and Joshua Mata, leader of a militant labor group, were among more than 1,000 people marching towards the Malacanang Presidential Palace but were blocked by police. When the protesters refused to disperse, the anti-riot policemen began hitting some of the male demonstrators with their sticks to force the rally to break up. Police then arrested Barakel and Mata, literally dragging the two into their vehicles. Barakel was later freed without any case filed, while Mata was released after police filed illegal assembly charges against him. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gurly Linao in Manila.
In Washington, D.C., the House of Representatives approved the reauthorization of the USA Patriot Act last night. The bill will make 14 controversial provisions permanent and will extend two others for an additional 4 years. President Bush is expected to sign the bill into law before the end of the week. In the Senate, an agreement was reached yesterday on the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP. An additional $1 billion will be distributed to help low-income people pay for their home energy bills. Senators from warm and cold climate states reached an agreement on how the funds will be dispersed, with additional heating assistance going to those who need it this winter and cooling assistance to those who will endure scorching temperatures this summer. Food supplies are dwindling in Gaza's markets 3 weeks after the closure of the area's main crossing point for commercial and humanitarian supplies. Leila Haddad reports from Gaza City.
According to the United Nations, Gaza's 1.3 million residents are experiencing severe food shortages as a result of the Israeli-imposed economic closure, now in its third week. The closure began just before the new Hamas-dominated parliament took power. Last month, Israeli Prime Ministerial Advisor Dov Weisglass was quoted as saying that the idea behind the closure policy was to, quote, put the Palestinians on a diet but not make them die of hunger. Flour mills have shut down, dairy products and fruits have virtually disappeared from Gaza markets, and essential supplies are expected to run out by Saturday. For Free Speech Radio News in Gaza, this is Leila Al-Haddad.
Lawmakers in Argentina's capital have ousted the mayor for his administration's failure to enforce safety laws. Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
A committee of Buenos Aires city deputies yesterday voted 10-4 to sack Mayor Aníbal Ibarra on charges of negligence and corruption. Relatives and friends of those who died in the massive nightclub fire celebrated the verdict outside the legislature, embracing each other and holding photos of victims. Ibarra was suspended from office in November pending an investigation into the accusations, along with charges of irregularities in the city's licensing and fire inspections of the club. Investigations indicate that the club was overcrowded when a flare ignited highly flammable soundproofing material. The emergency exits were locked, and 194 people, mostly teenagers, asphyxiated from toxic smoke. The impeachment trial of Ibarra has become a center of political tensions and national debate as how to hold politicians accountable in a nation where many complain leaders enjoy widespread impunity. Ibarra has been banned from public office for 10 years. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
On International Women's Day, women's groups from around the world strongly criticized the United Nations and its Secretary General Kofi Annan for failing to ensure women's equal participation in running the affairs of the world body. Heather Risby reports from the United Nations.
Women leaders from more than 50 countries have sent a letter to the UN chief in which they accused him of paying only lip service to the issue of gender equality. In the letter, women's groups said the UN is going in the wrong direction by offering only token representation of women on the organization's high-level expert panels and senior positions. The UN is currently undergoing reforms to make itself more effective and efficient organization, but women's groups say such an initiative would be meaningless unless the world body ensures full gender equality in its own rank and file. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Immigrant rights supporters are on Capitol Hill intensely lobbying lawmakers in the Senate who are crafting new legislation. Rights advocates continue pushing for a bill that will provide legalization and are strongly opposed to legislation already passed in the House of Representatives, which they say would further criminalize undocumented immigrants. Leanne Caldwell has more from Capitol Hill.
Thousands of Latino immigrants rallied in front of the Capitol last night. Some signs read, "We are not criminals."
We are not criminals who want to work and support our families.
Julia Hernandez said he came to support the cause. He is not worried because he says he works and pays taxes. But immigrant rights groups are worried about a bill that passed the House of Representatives late last year. The bill, authored by Republican James Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin, ensures strict interior enforcement. It creates criminal penalties and means for prosecution of undocumented people. Repercussions are either deportation or jail. But what worries immigrant rights supporters most is that it broadens the definition of immigrant smuggling. It would prosecute those who provide aid to any person with undocumented status. Sylvia Ramirez spent this week on Capitol Hill meeting with senators to urge opposition to the House bill.
If you are giving work with undocumented people, you're going to be a criminal. If you have people into your family, like sisters or family or friends, you're going to be a criminal.
Today, 1,500 Irish immigrants wearing LegalizeTheIrish.org t-shirts rallied against this enforcement-based immigration reform. Mark didn't want to give his last name. He says there are 50,000 undocumented Irish immigrants in the United States.
Since 9/11, things have got extremely tough for illegal aliens in this country, and a lot of them are getting classed as probably not in the same bracket as, you know, they should be. You know, we're here to work, we're here to pay our taxes, we're here to live like Americans, we're here to live the American dream. That's what we're here for. We're not here for any other reason.
Lobbying has intensified because the Senate Judiciary Committee is in the process of crafting its own immigration legislation. Their bill is more broad in that it includes a temporary worker program and provides a path to legal residency. But the Senate bill, in its preliminary form, does include provisions similar to those in the House bill. It would prosecute undocumented people and those who aid them. Some on the committee are looking to strike those provisions from the bill.
It changes the rules in the middle of the game and applies new consequences to old actions and could result in taking immigrants, including permanent residents, away from their U.S. citizen families without even having an opportunity to have their day in court.
Senator Edward Kennedy from Massachusetts.
By expanding the provisions under the alien smuggling in Section 205, a member of a religious organization sends money to a Chinese victim of religious persecution in China so that she can buy a plane ticket to leave the country. She could be punished if she did not have permission to come to the U.S.
Those skeptical of strict enforcement provisions say it will only keep undocumented immigrants in the shadows through fear. But some support strict enforcement. Republican Senator John Kyle from Arizona says that enforcement is the only way to deter unlawful entry.
And when you start saying that facilitating the illegal entry into the United States of someone is not a crime or shouldn't be pursued, we're going to be right back into the situation that we see ourselves in right now.
Currently, it is estimated that 11 to 12 million undocumented immigrants live in the U.S. They go unaccounted for, which is why many receive no penalty. Opponents of mandatory enforcement say that the answer to immigration reform is to offer legalization. A debate on that is also expected. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The Republican-controlled Senate Select Committee on Intelligence voted to expand oversight of the National Security Agency's warrantless surveillance program. Republican members, however, rejected requests from Democrats to conduct a full-scale investigation into the program. Selena Masuda has more.
Republican members of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence reached an agreement with the White House to create a 7-member subcommittee that would oversee Bush's domestic spying policy, as long as the White House approves of the plan. This falls short of what Democrats had hoped for, which was a detailed investigation of all activities by the National Security Agency after September the 11th, 2001. Brittany Benowitz is a fellow at the Center for National Security Studies.
People on the Hill have said, how can we legislate if we don't know if innocent people are being swept up? I mean, how many people have been swept up in this program? We don't know if it's 1,000 or 100,000. The fact that, at the request of the White House, Republican members of the committee refuse to have an inquiry and are proceeding with legislation which would authorize the program, which, by all accounts, to date has been operating outside of the law, raises serious questions about whether or not innocent people are being wiretapped.
There is, however, a push within Republican circles to put the presidential policy into the law books. 4 Republican members of the committee, led by Ohio Senator Mike DeWine, have proposed draft legislation known as the Terrorist Surveillance Act of 2006 that would require the White House to provide reasons for eavesdropping warrants that extend beyond 45 days and would include a sunset of 5 years on the program if that were not extended by Congress. White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan says that the president is open to working with DeWine.
We want to continue to work with him and others, as I said, on legislation that would codify into law what the president's authority already is. And I think that you're going to be hearing more from members in a short amount of time on some of their ideas.
Not all Republicans support the president's surveillance program, which has drawn criticism for possible civil rights violations. Pennsylvania Republican Senator and Judiciary Chairman Arlen Specter.
I do not think that the legislation is sufficient in permitting the surveillances to continue without warrants, without a determination of constitutionality. That is squarely opposed to the long-standing law prescribed pursuant to the Fourth Amendment, prohibiting unreasonable search and seizures to require a magistrate a judicial determination of probable cause.
Reporting from Washington, D.C., I am Selena Masuda for Free Speech Radio News.
Hurricane specialists have found that the levees being rebuilt around the city of New Orleans are being constructed to reflect climate data that hasn't been updated since the 1950s. This recent discovery by Louisiana State University is the latest in a number of challenges the Army Corps of Engineers has faced in attempting to reconstruct the city's levee system, which will not be ready to protect the city from another major storm by the start of the 2006 hurricane season. Christian Roseland has more.
Staff at Louisiana State University's Hurricane Center told reporters at a local New Orleans paper on Tuesday the information used to create models for levee protection is based on 1959 data. These researchers say that the level of levee protection should have been raised to resist flooding from a Category 4 storm, not the Category 3 of the 1959 data was based on. This is only the latest in a number of challenges to current plans for rebuilding of the levees that have surfaced in recent weeks. In late February, the American Society of Civil Engineers released a report saying that there were 4 key areas that warranted urgent attention, including a recommendation that earth and levee banks be armored with concrete. The Army Corps of Engineers is currently spending $770 million on an emergency plan to repair damaged levees by June 1st, the official start of hurricane season. However, Stuart Wakes of the Corps told New Orleans residents at a public meeting last month that protection would only be rebuilt to pre-existing levels.
Task Force Guardian is only authorized under emergency funding to bring the flood protection that was damaged back to pre-authorized elevations. Hurricane Katrina was well exceeded that. And of course, you know, on the Inner Harbor Navigation Canal, you had overtopping, which was evident nearly along 100% of it. So if you had a Category 4, Category 5 storm, the overtopping would be worse.
Other groups involved in planning point to the importance of coastal wetlands, which they say protected Louisiana in the past from major hurricanes. The American Society of Landscape Architects, or ASLA, in a panel late February said that restoration efforts have suffered from a lack of government funding. Dennis Carmichael, president of the ASLA.
And that is, about a year ago, there was a bill that went to Congress for about $14 billion to completely restore the barrier islands and coastal ecosystem of the Mississippi River Delta. And that's a lot of money. So they didn't approve it. Well, the bill for Katrina is now going to be well over $100 billion, depending on which estimate you read.
President Bush, who visited New Orleans today, has included a request for more money to armor New Orleans levees in a supplemental spending request to Congress, bundled with a much greater sum for ongoing military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Past requests have faced tough challenges in Congress, where House Speaker Dennis Hastert has still not apologized for remarks that he made in September suggesting that the city not be rebuilt. For FSRN, I'm Christian Roseland.
As part of the 50th United Nations Commission on the Status of Women, MADRE, a women's activist group started in 1983 that traveled to Nicaragua to witness the effects of the U.S.-sponsored Contra War, co-hosted a panel with other women's rights organizations to discuss violence against indigenous women. The panel heard how legislation protecting women and human rights was increasing, but that such legislation rarely translated to actually improving the lives of women in indigenous communities located far from major cities. FSRN's Rebecca Miles attended the panel and files this report.
The panel included Nelsa Stampa Tupulu, Chief Secretariat of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, who talked about data collection and petitioning the state. Two women contributed testimony about the lived experiences of many indigenous women, which showed the gap between legislation and data gathering and the effects experienced daily by many women. Contributing to the panel was Lucky Sherpa, who's the executive director with the Himalayan Indigenous Women's Network in Nepal, and she talked about what she sees going on daily for her and also what's happening in the Philippines.
In my country, Nepal, because of the February 1st move of the king control over the power, there is no rule of law, and every day there is a case of human rights violation. The report on Philippines by Rodolfo Stavenhaven. The physical and sexual violence against the indigenous women, the poverty, which has been accelerated by globalization policies, is increasing the vulnerability of indigenous women to violence, both sexual and physical. In search of jobs, many indigenous women are trafficked to other parts of the country, or even across borders, are eventually pushed to prostitution. At the same time, the indigenous women who are living in urban centers become the victims of wife battering by their husbands, who find themselves jobless or are unable to support their families, become irritable or addicted to drugs and alcohol. Uprooted from the communities, indigenous women who migrate lose the protection afforded by customary laws.
There was a Q&A session following the panel discussion, and two women stood up to point out how legislation, while in principle is good, lacks enforcement. Even when the government backs the legislation, a delegate from South Africa said sometimes the problem isn't even at the government level.
Like in our case, a beautiful Domestic Violence Act, and it's working in some areas. But the officials are the ones who are holding the process. How do you take this process forward?
There was another delegate from Kenya who said,
whom can I hold accountable when my own government sees me as second-class citizen?
Elsa Stampa Pulu has asked MADRE to present the results of the panel at the next session of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues in May. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles, reporting from New York.
While legislation against domestic violence is ignored in some parts of the world, the mere existence of domestic violence continues to be denied in others. But as FSRN's Severine Bardon reports from Beijing, things are beginning to change in China.
You first need to protect yourself. You have to prevent him from hurting you again. And if he keeps beating you, you have to go to the hospital or to the police station.
The hotline, set up in March 2004 in Beijing by the Maple Women's Psychological Counseling Center, records every day several phone calls from distressed women. Domestic violence occurs in a third of China's 267 million homes, but the recognition of its existence and preventive measures are just starting to appear, as explains Cui Xiangmi, a volunteer with the hotline.
Once I had a call from a woman who had been beaten for years. She had never called before, but had just read an article in a newspaper about domestic violence. That's how she realized she was a victim of this kind of violence and could reach out for help.
But if the awareness of the problem is improving in the cities, the situation stays much more complicated in the countryside. The police often refuse to interfere in what they consider private matters, and beaten women don't even get the support of their own parents, explains Song Meiya, editor-in-chief of a magazine on Chinese women.
I remember once I was doing research on a woman who had tried to commit suicide 3 times. The first time was after she went back home to her parents, after her husband had beaten her very badly and said she wanted a divorce. Her father told her that he would beat her to death himself if she dared to file for a divorce.
Under such social pressure, legal provisions are often too weak to protect beaten women in the country. Local associations trying to improve the rights of women have thus focused their work on convincing men that women are their equal. But the road will be very long to change ways of thinking, as underlines Song Meiya.
I did a poll in the countryside and asked the people what their opinion was on the following proverb: the woman I marry and the horse I buy, I'm the one to ride them and I'm the one to beat them. In the countryside, 1 out of 4 persons polled agreed with this statement.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Séverine Bardon in Beijing.
The economic, social, and psychological effects of globalization have taken their toll on women in the Third World. FSRN's Nan McCurdy spoke with coordinators active in the women's movement in Nicaragua about their continued struggle against the consequences of globalization.
This International Women's Day, the globalization of the neoliberal economic model is on trial in Nicaragua. Women accuse globalization of reducing women's access to justice, health care, education, decent employment, and basic food security. Juanita Jimenez, coordinator of the Women's Network Against Violence, laments that women today are less likely to get justice in cases of gender violence.
Latin America continues to be the backyard of the United States and their market. We're supposed to consume their products and also their policies and programs. An effect of globalization is having a penal process code imposed in Nicaragua that's totally foreign to our culture. It's a bad copy of the North American system. The North American system of justice is paid for and negotiated. This is a negative effect of globalization for women.
Eva Maria Samke, director of a professional women's association, says that free trade agreements lead to less food security for Nicaraguan families.
Globalization is the tyranny of the free market. Suddenly, we find ourselves planting for export and we don't understand that we need to be producing for our own consumption.
In about 40% of Nicaraguan families, women are the heads of the household. With unemployment and emigration, 48% of women over 60 continue to be the head of the household and caretakers of the grandchildren left behind. Maria Jesus Tenorio is an investigator for a women's center, Si Mujer.
With the prescriptions of the international organizations, like the World Bank and the International Development Bank, each day women have less access to health care. The problems of breast and cervical cancer in women are worse. They have less access to cervical exams because they are expensive. Next year, women are not going to have access to contraceptive methods. It's an order that comes from the fundamentalist government of Bush to reduce spending on contraceptives.
Maria Aguilera, director of youth projects for IXCHEN, an organization dedicated to women's health, talks about employment and emigration.
Globalization came to put an obstacle in the life of our women. For women, it means less employment or denigrating employment. There is now terrible malnourishment, and we've gone back in literacy. You go by a house, and there is a 14-year-old taking care of 3 younger children. The dad is in Costa Rica, and the mom is in the United States. What kind of family is that? This is what globalization has brought us, the destruction of the family.
For Free Speech Radio News from Managua, I'm Nan McCurdy.
As schools across the United States struggle to cope with diminishing budgets and the educational pressures of the No Child Left Behind Act, one South Dakota community is fighting to keep a dying legacy of education alive. FSRN's Jim Kent visited with residents of Oral, South Dakota, to discuss the future of their community schoolhouse and what they're willing to do to keep it open.
The one-room schoolhouse once existed in every rural area of the United States, but is rapidly disappearing as school districts close down these historic learning centers to reduce costs and consolidate student populations. Residents of Oral, South Dakota met at the local firehouse recently to discuss plans to close their two-room community school, which dates back half a century. The local school district has advised the community that Oral School will be closing at the end of the school year in order to reduce operating costs in the district's budget. Oral residents question the legitimacy of those claims. Marla Peters examined the school district's budget figures and came away with questions.
We're paying to educate our children in that district, tax dollar-wise. I've spoken with the business manager. I've spoken with Mr. Hagedorn about it, and I've spoken to the board about it, and I don't think anyone had the information that they needed to make that kind of a decision, because they can't show me hard figures.
Mr. Hagedorn is the Hot Springs School District Superintendent and the only official permitted to speak on the issue.
I would say that it's prompted primarily by the school district needing to cut $300,000 out of our budget. And when you consider that 80% of a school district's budget is based upon benefits and salaries for employees. So the only place that you can make an appreciable change in a budget of that size or that amount would be through staffing.
When it was noted that Oral School only employs two teachers whose combined salaries don't approach the required $100,000 budget reduction marked for Oral School, Vern Hagedorn quickly added concerns over the costs of heating and electricity for the small two-room schoolhouse. But Marla Peters doesn't buy that reason either.
You know, there's always been animosity in Hot Springs towards Oral. They don't like the fact that we have our own little school.
Perceptions of such big dog, little dog control issues may seem like paranoia brought on by small town politics, but they do feed the reality that the school district's attorney wouldn't allow teachers or students to be interviewed for this story while on school property. Whatever the real reason for closing the Oral School, which Mr. Hagedorn calls an attendance center, the bigger issue, says community member Nancy Hussey, is what the impact will be on the community's children.
They get a better education here than anywhere else. I mean, kids learn how to play with other kids. Eighth graders learn how to take care of little kids, be nice to them, to teach them things, and be their best friends. That's why we need our school. They don't learn that in big schools.
Studies on the benefits of multi-age classroom education date back to at least 1995, according to the Harvard Education Letter. Among the positives of one- and two-room school classes are better relationships with teachers, improved self-esteem, reduced peer pressure, and better socialization skills, as well as higher academic achievement. Oral school students agree with their parents' protests. And if a planned injunction request doesn't keep the Oral two-room schoolhouse open, community members plan to form a homeschooling network to educate their children themselves. For FSRN, I'm Jim Kent at the Oral Firehouse in Oral, South Dakota.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Leanne Caldwell is our Washington editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Jade Padgett-Seekins, Eric Klein, and Antonio Ortiz. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.